You are listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the Podcast Network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, October 13th, 2010. This is episode 153, Tech Cobbling. It's time again for another edition of the Wells Tech Podcast. My name is Martin Spriggs, the Synod's Chief Technology Officer, and joining me as usual, Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Martin. I'm joining you on a brand new microphone today, so we're going to see how this goes with new sound technology on the Wells Tech Podcast.
And what is that microphone?
Well, it is a blue Yeti. Had a really interesting box with a Yeti on it. Really recommended for podcasting purposes, so we're hoping to improve the sound quality. I want to sound like I'm right there in the room with you, even though I'm coming to you from the tech capital of Wells here in Sleepy Eye, Minnesota.
Via Skype, as
That's
usual.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we haven't done a show in a long time talking about the technology we use, but all this runs through Skype, and we've got a couple computers set up here in my office that have Skype for Sally, and then we have a separate one for Skype for our interviewees, and we've got a good one today, which we'll share in a little bit. That all runs through a Lesis mixer and is all recorded on a Marantz solid state, little handheld, well, it's a little bit bigger than a handheld device that does a great job to a CF card. So I think we've got this down. We're just trying to tweak a little bit, and hopefully the microphone change will be a nice addition to the sound quality. But let us know, because we're kind of in the forest, and we need somebody in people who listen to us in all kinds of different settings to let us know how we're doing. But again, I have a disclaimer every show, whether it's said or unsaid, that I'm no sound engineer.
You're our sound engineer, and you do a great job.
Yeah,
so
whatever.
Always improving.
All right. So what's the topic of the day, Sally?
Today we are going to talk about leading 21st century schools. We are returning to our book discussion. This is a book that was recommended and highly sought after when I started looking for an educational technology focused book. Mm-hmm. And it really focuses on technology from a leadership perspective, and certainly applies to our school principals that may be listening in the audience. Also, teachers, obviously, in the classroom setting who have the ability to influence the technology plans within the schools across our listenership. But I think it applies to all kinds of leaders and in everything that we do, having that vision of how technology can assist us with the ministry we're trying to carry out. So certainly pastors and others who are listening can get something from this book as well.
Yep. And chapter one we did last time, and that really talked a lot about standards, which was a real learning experience for me. I was not that familiar with standards-based education methodologies in the classroom or elsewhere. So that was good for me to go through. And then the chapter today, chapter two, really gets at the people involved. Who are the students? Let's define them, what their background is, what are their what is about them that is unique, and what about the teachers? And there's some general classifications that are thrown out there that really was the subject of a talk that I did last week, the concept of digital immigrants and digital natives. Digital immigrants being like you and me, Sally, us old folks who have kind of migrated or immigrated into this digital or electronic revolution, this high-tech world that we live in. And then, of course, the digital natives are those people that are in our classrooms today that have never known a time when there was not technology in their life.
That's right. They've grown up with YouTube and CDs. They've never seen pay telephone booths, practically, or a lot of the things that were just normal for us as we grew up, Martin. And so quite the difference. And I think the authors, Lynn Schramm and Barbara Levine, do a really good job of pointing out that we have a flux in the teaching roles now, where we're moving some teachers that are digital natives into those roles as well. So as leaders, we're having to deal not only with students who are digital natives, but also with the coming of age of a population of teachers who have a whole different perspective of looking at things as well.
Yeah, and that's got to create at least some natural tension, whether it be healthy or unhealthy, within, you know, the faculty room, within the staffs, and not just there, but also within the classroom, where if you have a digital immigrant teaching digital natives, there is a there's some things that need to happen for education to continue to go on, and that needs to be addressed, and that's kind of what this book is about.
Right. This chapter does a great job. I just felt like it was a gold mine. Lynn and Barbara quote a lot of different statistics related to these generations. And typically, we're talking about what would be called millennials, those born from the 1980s to the 2000s. And then the next generation, Generation Z, they're referred to, those born since the year 2000. And, you know, just the differences in the lives that they lead, you know, how many actually own a computer and a cell phone and do text messaging and are on Facebook and all those different digital things that are just the norm today.
Yep. I'm struggling to keep up with some of this lingo. You know, it was hard enough with just the baby boomers. Now we've got Gen Xers, Gen Ys, millennials, and now Gen Zs, which is making up the kind of the lower grades of our classrooms of today. And some of the statistics that they threw out there were really even amazed me, where I almost questioned, you know, whether this was even possible. But they just did a survey just of millennials, and millennials are those 1980 to 2000s, you know, birth dates. How many of them own computers? How many of them own cell phones? And 97% of those born in the 80s to the early 2000s own a computer. 94% own cell phones. 76% use instant messaging and social networking sites. I mean, the list just goes on and on. 75% have Facebook accounts. Just incredible.
Yeah, and Martin, as you mentioned earlier, this was kind of the focus of that trip that you made up to northern Wisconsin last week, and you put together a really excellent presentation that we're going to be able to share a link to in our show notes that just addresses digital immigrants teaching digital natives, and some really great videos and thought-provoking links and things that you included there. So I think our listeners will definitely want to check out your presentation.
Well, thank you. It was, and I am definitely no expert. You know, I would admit that right off, and I did when I began the presentation. But I think one of the reasons that I did the presentation was to just raise some questions. You know, what are we going to do about this? You know, as I was addressing, you know, a mixed audience of pastors and teachers, and some were digital, and most were digital immigrants, but there were a few digital natives in the crowd. Really good discussion on what are the issues, and what are the challenges, not just with, you know, the education process, but with privacy and our kids thinking about things a little bit differently than we might have, or we would maybe like them to think about their own privacy and oversharing and things like that. Very interesting dialogue. So again, it's not going to answer many questions, but it's really going to raise, I think, the right questions to be thinking about as we move forward. And to be honest, I think the book that we're discussing answers some of those questions.
And, you know, I didn't go to northern Wisconsin. I did my own little case study right here in CPI. I had a discussion yesterday with my third, fourth, and fifth graders in computer lab, and we were talking about these very issues, being, you know, maintaining our privacy online and things like that. And of the kids in the class, and it was a fairly small group that we were talking with, three or four of them actually admitted to having Facebook accounts. Mm-hmm. And if you know about Facebook's policies and, you know, generally privacy policies related to children under the age of 13,
right.
If you, you know, put your actual birthday on Facebook, it will not allow you to create an account if
right.
you're under age 13. So, I mean, they were admitting to me that they had circumvented that with a false birthday, basically.
Yep.
And one little boy just innocently raised his hand and said, isn't lying a sin? You know, I mean, so it was a really useful conversation with these youngsters, these Generation Z
right.
babies that mm-hmm. are out there living this in their digital native way. So.
Yep. So, yeah, I think this chapter really does a nice job of setting this up. And then beyond that, then the rest of the book essentially talks about the different tools at the disposal of the digital immigrant teacher to get up to speed and some techniques to begin to connect their digital natives to the educational content they want to get across with some tools that these digital natives are very comfortable with, whether that be the social networking stuff or many others that I found, you know, really insightful. I mentioned this, and we're going to have the interview with Lynn Trum on here too, but the one of the neat things about the book, and I say this in the interview too, is the numerous examples that are provided. I mean, they really did their homework. This is not just, you know, sitting down and banging out some pages on Microsoft Word and then submitting this to the publisher. They did a lot of research. And so in that regard, it's a very useful book for educators.
Yeah, I really like each chapter has one school leader's story where they look at a real case study of a particular leader and what he's done. And in this chapter, they just explore a principal who really led in terms of you know, a mixed staff of teachers, including mm-hmm. many millennials who liked, you know, collaboration and flexibility, but led his school into integrating technology at a really high level. And basically, he did it by just encouraging them, by being having some fun along the way, being respectful of what they were learning. He sent them to conferences that he thought met their particular skills, mm-hmm. and then he had them present those topics to their own staff, and
right.
so they got a chance to reinforce it that way. So just a really good example of an excellent leader right here in this chapter.
Mm-hmm. So Sally, you want to set up the interview here with Lynn?
Well, I was so excited because we, you know, reached out to the author, Lynn Trum, of our book selection, and she just responded gung-ho to talk to us here on Wells Tech. And mm-hmm. so, and honestly, you know, couldn't talk with a happier, more confident lady in the message that she has with her book and the fact that leadership and technology really go hand in hand in today's day and age. And so I think you guys will enjoy meeting Lynn. She is a professor at George Mason University, and she had a lot to share with us. So let's listen to our interview with Lynn Trum.
Joining us today on the Wells Tech Podcast, we're very pleased to have Lynn Trum from Fairfax, Virginia. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning.
And Lynn is the professor of elementary and secondary education at George Mason University. And really the reason that we're interested in talking with Lynn is we've been reviewing her book on our podcast, Leading 21st Century Schools, Harnessing Technology for Engagement and Achievement. Very good of you to join us, Lynn. Thank you for taking the time. Maybe a good place to start would be letting you share a little bit about yourself, what you're doing, what you've done in the past, some current interests, and maybe what a little bit about the book and some of the studies that went into making this this book.
Delighted to answer that question, Martin. Of course, I've been around for so long that this may take a long time. But,
well, give us the Reader's Digest version.
Right, exactly. I was an elementary teacher and got passionate about technology, went back and got a PhD long ago, and have been a teacher educator for the better part of 20 years. So I've been in a lot of institutions, or several institutions, I guess that makes more sense. My passion has been teacher education and technology in appropriate ways to excite, engage, and really to teach, not just for the fun of using new toys, although I admit to being a little bit of a toy person myself. I think the interesting thing has been, as I've been a researcher for a long time, and I edit a research journal, the Journal of Research on Technology and Education, and have done that for quite some time, I keep seeing the same things over and over again, and we don't seem to be making a lot of headway, and I think that's been frustrating in some ways to a lot of people who have been involved in creating appropriate uses. And I like to stress that, because I think technology is not a solution. People always want to find it as a solution, and it's not. So I've been doing these research studies for a long time. I was in a department of instructional technology for 9 years at the University of Georgia, and again, kept seeing a sort of dichotomy between technology and teacher education, and that's been very frustrating. I also count myself as one of those who believes teachers often get a bad rap for not using technology or for not doing some of the things that some people think they should, and that frustrates me as a former teacher, and I consider myself an educator. So that's kind of where I've been. I've done some books, Web 2.0, New Tools, New Schools for ISTE, the International Society for Technology and Education, and also have the honor of serving as its president for a few years. We have a new book coming out on tools, but again, it's focused on what teachers can do, and I think that's been where I've kind of been focused for a long time.
So that leads right into my first question for you, Lynn, is, you know, why now? Why did you see the need for this particular book, Leading 21st Century Schools, which is really kind of targeted at your school administration level workers? What was the need for that in this time period?
It's a great question, Sally, and I thank you for asking it. As I said, we see pockets of teachers doing exceptional things, educators around the world doing really interesting, engaging activities. But more and more, we kept hearing of the frustration sometimes when things didn't get encouraged or supported, or the essential conditions weren't there. And some grad students and I did a study looking at all 50 states and what was required of administrators before they got their initial license for being a school principal or a superintendent. We scoured the websites of, as I said, all 50 states, and then what we found was really sad. Almost, I think there's one state that mentions technology in its recommended activities that a school leader should have before they become a principal. And then we looked at a lot of the most prominent sort of teacher education and school leader licensure institutions in all 50 states. And again, what we found is a very small number mention technology, mention school change or leading with technology as a requirement. Now, clearly a lot of school leaders do a lot of wonderful things, but it's not a sort of focus of any institution or any state that this is important. So that led us to this book, saying unless a teacher, a group of teachers, has a school leader who supports in a lot of ways what that change needs to be, they're not necessarily going to take the risk. They're not going to spend their time really focused on infusing technology in appropriate ways. And they may not have the requirements that they need to be able to do that.
Or
does
the,
that make sense?
Yeah, sure. And the funding as well that really needs to kind of be built into the administrative process of running a school. So it can't be what I think I'm hearing you saying, it can't be really a grassroots kind of thing or a niche or a hobby. It really has to be a part of the educational process as the administrator, as the principal sees it.
I think that's exactly right. We did some other grad students and I did a study of what we called tech-savvy teachers. We found in one state, probably almost 100 people who had identified themselves as tech-savvy. And what we found was they use the technology in a lot of ways. They spent a lot of their own money. They spent a lot of their own time. They did it because they saw the power for their students, which, of course, I believe drives good teachers everywhere. It's because they are committed to improving the lives of their students. So these teachers did this in many ways on their own dime and their own time. And some of them did have leaders who supported it. But let's be honest, any of us, we do what our bosses, whoever that boss may be, for me it's the dean, what he wants me to do, or she, that's what I'm going to do because I want to please them and get the reward. So if we could make that more a fundamental, that seems to be the kind of driving force that's needed.
Mm-hmm. I think back to the book a little bit. I was up in northern Wisconsin yesterday delivering a presentation on digital natives and how there is that gap, can be that gap between digital immigrants and digital natives, which you do a great job of explaining in the book here. So your book was an invaluable resource. And as a result of some of the prep, I read through most of the book. And one thing that I really like about your book is, and one thing that I'm really impressed with, is the amount of research that you've done into actual examples. You know, it's one thing to talk about this theoretically, you know, that standards should be such and you ought to be thinking about these kinds of things, but to actually go into some of the detail on, hey, this class did this and this school did that, that really makes this very practical, where a teacher can read this or an administrator can read this and say, hey, this is not impossible. This is being done.
I'm glad you like that. We talked a lot about it, and the world doesn't need another academic sort of scholarly book on this. I think it needs the on the ground kind of activity. So I'm glad you appreciated that. Thank you.
Very helpful.
So, Lynn, let's kind of take it to the other extreme. Perhaps you're a leader in a school situation, but you're meeting resistance from certain teachers who maybe feel threatened by the new expectations that you're putting on them in terms of technology. Do you have some advice for those types of situations?
You know, Sally, I've done a lot of research over the years, and one of the things I've learned is it's really, especially with technology, because A, it changes so fast, and B, there are people who are concerned, fearful, uncertain. The best thing I've ever seen is when you really differentiate. You know, we ask our teachers to differentiate instruction for all of their students, and I think that would be the watchword I would say to a school leader who wanted to implement some change. We need to identify and help individuals identify where they are. There are all kinds of instruments around where somebody can say, here's what I don't know, or here's where my knowledge stops. And then go beyond that and ask them, how do you want to learn this? So that if what they want is quiet, private, one-on-one, let's try and provide that. If instead they'd like to learn in a collaborative sort of bigger group, then let's do that. So in other words, we want to take them where they are and move them to the very next step. And we also want to give them the comfort level of learning in a situation that makes sense. The last thing adults need is to be embarrassed either in front of their students or in front of their colleagues because they don't know something. So let's not put people in a situation where they are going to be uncomfortable and resistant. The other thing, I think, for a long time, technology professional development was just in case, you know, let's all learn a spreadsheet just in case you ever need one. Mm-hmm. Well, that has been proven over and over again not to be very successful. So instead, let's do it just in time. Let's spend the time talking to teachers. What are you going to teach next week? What do you think might help you teach that? And then I'm going to provide you with the answer and with some suggestions for ways to include technology or to make it easier. Here's an example. I like to think about classifying rocks. I remember a geology class I took, and we classified rocks. And, you know, classifying rocks is very complicated and intense. Imagine doing that with or without a database situation where you could pull up all the rocks that have this hardness and this characteristic. You know, it's a solution. It's an easy way to think about it. But if you don't know about databases, you're never going to think about them. Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is find that person who's teaching about rocks and help them understand the power of the technology that could help them. And then they're going to be wildly eager to learn that specific task.
Yeah. You almost have to jumpstart the brain at that point, saying, here's the connection.
Exactly, exactly. And some of my, long ago, when I was a poor graduate student, one of the things I used to do was consult with school districts, and you'd go in and you'd sit with first grade teachers, and we'd talk about what do you do in first grade? Well, in first grade, they make big books that kids can see and that they collaborate on the text. And when first grade teachers understand that there's a piece of software that makes big books, of course, now you don't even have to buy the software. It's all online, and you can still print it out, and every child can have a big book to take home that he or she has helped create and knows the words and can read to mom and dad. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that we want to. But again, a school leader needs to understand that investing in that kind of professional development is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Absolutely.
Big part of your book, Lynn, is the identification and recommendation of tools. And each section, almost every section, you talk about specific mm-hmm. tools that a teacher could use to enable some kind of learning experience that's not possible or more difficult without some of these tools. Are there any that you'd maybe want to highlight for our listeners that you see as being especially successful or maybe ubiquitous across educational circumstances that kind of must-have tools that you see work?
I guess the tools that I'm most excited about are the ones that put the power in the students' hands.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Picasa or Wordle, where they can create a graphic out of their text.
Mm-hmm.
Things where students can edit their pictures and can create graphical representations of things. Things that allow the teacher to take away from, not do away with standardized tests, because in this environment we can't do that, and we could have a long conversation about whether or not we should.
Right.
That's for another day. But things that allow students to have authentic ways of documenting their knowledge that may not be text-driven.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing I really like is TeacherTube. You know, we've all been taught not to use YouTube because there are some things there that we absolutely do not want our students to know or see or be exposed to. But TeacherTube has some really nice little videos that present things that are complicated. I'm thinking of dividing fractions, that somebody has spent some time creating that are really very entertaining but also explanatory, mm-hmm. that a teacher doesn't have to reinvent but can go to TeacherTube and put in a content specific kind of activity, mm-hmm. and then there are some explanatory videos that are short, and students learn in those ways. So again, we're meeting the children. I think one of the saddest things for me is the recognition of the number of our students who are bored to tears or overwhelmed, the number of our students who drop out. I just saw something where some large percentage of our students drop out of high school, don't ever finish, not just students who are marginal learners, but also some of our best and brightest. And they were looking at that issue in Finland, where they have perhaps one of the best education systems, and they don't have any dropouts because mm-hmm. they meet students where they are. And so anything we can do to keep kids engaged in school, I think, is a good thing.
So there's that engagement dimension.
It really is.
Also,
yeah.
the fact that they feel that this is relevant, you know, that this is something that is useful.
And authentic. Right. So instead of pretend activities, let's give them something meaningful. Let's look at water and the lack thereof mm-hmm. in the world, or let's get kids involved in solving local problems with data. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. And there are lots of tools now, free tools, that you can do that.
Very good. Yeah. And any that you've uncovered since the book was published? I know we were excited to see some of the ones included in the book, but I wondered if you're like me, you kind of look for these new treasures to come out pretty regularly now.
I do. As I said, we've got a new book coming out this week, not Barb Levin and I, but Gwen Solomon and I. It's published by ISTE, and it's called Web 2.0, How To for Teachers. And it has a lot more examples of specific tools. And then what we did was we have small tools that didn't really rate a whole chapter. We took to calling them sliders, like baby hamburgers, because they're little tools.
That's but not as greasy,
in
yes.
the book, but that was our nickname for them. And we got people around the world who use those tools in their classrooms, real teachers really using them. And we got them to write little descriptions. So we have about 20 or 30 of those in the new book. And they're real interesting. One is Wordle, one, you know, just things that are small uses that are very useful for teachers and very. What I like the most about them is that the learning curve is very shallow. So it doesn't take a year to learn a piece mm-hmm. of software or a month. It's get on there, play for 10 minutes, and you've got it.
Mm-hmm. Send a single-use things that have a very distinct purpose and are really easy to understand and grab a hold of.
Exactly. Right. And again, that book is coming out this week. So. And I can't remember all of them, but there's some real fun ones that are engaging and also incredibly academically oriented.
Sure. Is that book going to be an actual paper book that you can get on Amazon or something like that?
It is. Okay. It is. And as I said, it's called Web 2.0, How To for Educators.
Awesome.
And ISTE, that's the ISTE. .org. They tell us it's out this week.
Great. That's exciting.
Thank you.
Very good. I was going to ask you, as you're talking about, you know, some of these tools, how do you stay current? Do you have a PLN of your own that feeds you this stuff? Do you constantly go out and hunt? Do you interview? How do you stay on top of this industry?
That's a great question. Thank goodness I have doctoral students. And
Sally and I don't have those, so we have to rely on people like you.
Well, they'll show us. And I think, again, one of the things that we found with our tech-savvy teachers and that I try to emulate is never being embarrassed that I've never heard of a tool, because mm-hmm. it's impossible to stay current, but I just love when a doc student will say, well, don't you know about X? And I'll go, never heard of it, show me. So I really try to model that lifelong learning, you know, sort of, and then they'll show me something. I was just introduced to this free, it's called a Dropbox. That's the name of the tool. And basically, when you're in a large professional learning community or even a classroom, people can drop in updated documents or PowerPoints or anything, and it automatically subscribes you once you're in this. It just sort of populates your Dropbox all the time, so you have the latest and greatest. It was very, I was in a meeting for a couple of days and things were being dropped in all the time. So I go home and I have all of these documents that, that I now need without passing around thumb drives or anything. Very, very interesting.
Very good. Well, Lynn, we thought it might be appropriate for us to close with one of our favorite parts of your book, and that's One School Leader's Story. It kind of harkens back to what Martin was saying earlier, that you have these real-life stories sprinkled throughout the chapters of your book. And I just wondered if there was one in particular that stood out to you that you might share with our listeners today.
Oh, that's really hard. There's so many. One of the ones that I really liked was a superintendent. I'm not going to remember his name. I'm sorry, but he talked about how he made his principals and his parents aware of his focus, and then really continually returned to the idea of supporting people in all of those ways. I'm sorry, I really should have looked his name up, but I just found that the number of people around the world, but certainly in the U.S., who have those stories. I was going to say that we've got this new idea where we're going to schools and we're doing case studies of leaders who have made an impact. And I met a superintendent over the last couple of days who has done that. She has just allowed people to do what they need to do in this way, but she's made it clear that that's a focus of hers.
Sounds like a good communication platform as well. It's not just the doing, but also the educating by communicating that this is a focus and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Lynn, thank you so much for your time, and of course, thank you for your book. I will be one of the first buyers of your new book, because I think this sounds really exciting. And again, this is a great way for Sally and I to kind of keep up to date on these kinds of things as we harness the things that that you've been able to research and make sense of, which is really helpful. Because there's so much, as you mentioned, there is so much stuff out there, and some of it's garbage, and some of it's great, you know, and sometimes it's hard to differentiate between the two, and it's helpful to have these kinds of tools at our disposal to share with our listeners. So thanks so much for taking the time, and we look forward to your new book.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me, and I welcome any of your listeners to send me their stories, because that would be great.
And how do we do that?
My email is lschrum@gmu.edu. Sally, I know you've got it, and I'm more than happy if they want to send me an email message and tell me about something they're doing, because it might be in the next book.
Great. Do you maintain a blog or use Facebook or get your information out in any other ways other than your books?
Facebook. I am on Facebook. I don't have a blog. I just feel like I'd be too boring, but I am on Facebook and would be happy for people to friend me. I'm always interested in the next stories, and you know, the other thing is it's risky and uncomfortable to say what went wrong. It's one of the things I think we need to explore is, let's get out there the stories of what we did that didn't work so well and what we learned from it. I think that would be a fun book.
Very good. Again, thanks, Lynn. And
thank you.
So you're on your way to Alaska now, I understand.
Yeah,
so safe travels.
A lot of work in Anchorage, and this time I'm going to Sitka. I'm going to spend a week at a school district in the school district in Sitka, Alaska, working with school leaders and teachers and some others. And it's one of the best things that I get to do because I get to be, you know, really on the ground and work with people close up and personal. And that's really fun.
Oh, perfect. Terrific. Thanks for taking some time with us as you're way out the door.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again, Lynn, for taking the time as you were jet-setting off to Alaska, I think it was. Yes, so that was great of her to fit us into her, I'm sure, busy schedule, and very, very insightful. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we're looking forward to the rest of your book, Lynn, and we'll be thinking of you and watching for your next book to come down the pipe as well.
Yep, very good. All right, shall we move along to our ministry resources section? Again, this is an area where we look for things that might help people in ministry settings. Now, the whole show is really about that, but we look for little tools that might plug in nicely to niches within, whether it be pastor, teacher settings that could help them. So I found, I don't know if I found it or you found it, Sally, maybe we both saw this across our RSS readers. Google launched a new feature to their Google Translate function, and they've now added Latin, which anybody who attends any of our schools probably would really appreciate and take advantage of.
I have a Latin scholar under my roof right now. My oldest is in his second year of Latin, and so this is right up his alley, and we have all learned in the process, and what an excellent language to start with to study. Yeah. So, and it says they have nearly 60 languages in their Translate engine now. Mm-hmm. So really impressive.
Which I wish I had had this when I was going through school. Boy, this would have been a gold mine of resources. But I had to do it the old-fashioned way. But the kids today have all these advantages.
That's right.
I sound like a digital immigrant, don't I?
Millennials and Gen Zers.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. News and tech. What's going on out there?
Well, lots of things on the social networking side. Mm-hmm. Facebook has a new movie out, a social network movie.
Yep.
And I read an article that they are also going with more private groups, and so they're going to beef up their groups so that you can post your Facebook statuses just to specific people and not let everyone read your status updates, depending on what the subject of it might be. Yeah. So more changes coming. I think the more they grow, the more they're changing and evolving in the process.
Yep. Have you seen the Social Network movie yet, Sally?
I haven't, but I did read some bloopers or conflicts in it. Like
I saw
apparently
one too.
They show Windows XP with some Service Pack 3, which wasn't available at the time that the movie was set or whatever.
Right.
So
I saw that too. That's funny, but I plan on seeing it. I think there's a historicity, if that's the proper word, to this concept, at least for techies, that this started a revolution that is now encompassing, you know, 500 million people. So probably we're seeing. I did hear that it's not historically accurate in many parts, so Hollywood has done its thing to it and made it a little bit more dramatic maybe than it was. And maybe that's understandable because the life of a geek isn't all that interesting. So it is a matter that they may need to spice up a little bit. And then the whole groups concept, I'm kind of excited about, because as congregations begin to think about using Facebook, I think groups will come in handy, as you can segment portions of your congregation for different messages. And they're kind of comparing this to Google Groups, because you can set up an email function so that when a post is made, it goes out to those people on that list or on that group. So I haven't seen it appear in my Facebook installation yet, so I haven't even been able to try it. But I plan on doing that as our congregation is just getting into the Facebook space.
Very good. We also both, I believe, experienced the new Twitter.
We talked about this
a couple of weeks ago, that Twitter had announced a pretty major upgrade, and things are a little bit wider on the screen. The sidebar is quite a bit wider, and if you click into things, they kind of pop out into that sidebar space now. But beyond that, I think it's just more... a more convenient layout. I haven't seen a huge difference in the way I'm using Twitter.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, maybe you too, Martin, are not using Twitter online anyway. They're using some kind of Twitter client.
Right.
And so maybe it doesn't affect as many people for that reason.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying it. I'm gonna stick with the online Twitter client just to give it a shot and to see if it meets my needs. I'm not a huge Twitter guy. I don't have... probably as much dedication as I need to keep tweeting, but I do enjoy reading others, and I think this makes it easier. For instance, you can click on a tweet. I'm looking at our tweeting teacher, Jason Schmitz, the latest tweet here, and I can see now in the right column, you know, obviously the tweet itself, but any replies to the tweet, so the at Jason Schmidt 123, or other previous tweets from him, so I can kind of get a little bit of a history. There's other things that I can see about him as well, as far as all his information, all the number of tweets, how many people are following, on what lists he is on, those kinds of things. So I think it's got some potential. It seems to work pretty well.
Very good. And last up, you... let me know that there's a new version of Internet Explorer soon to be. Internet Explorer 9 is coming.
E9 is in beta, and I'm trying it out right now. It seems pretty snappy. There are some things that it does not work with as far as some of the extensions or some of the plugins or add-ons or whatever they're called. Add-ons, I think they are, in Internet Explorer. But it seems like a nice upgrade. What they have done, which is kind of nice, is they have integrated search into the toolbar, into the URL bar, just like Google Chrome has, which is really helpful. So you don't have now two boxes, one where you enter the URL and one where you enter your search term. So it's all in one, and that's they've gone with this tabbed approach, kind of a minimalistic approach, so you get more screen real estate. So it sounds pretty solid. I think they're back in the game, as it were, for a number of years, I think they've been struggling to keep up with the Firefoxes and the Chromes of the world. So they've done a nice job.
I'm just struggling to keep up with all the new versions of software. It gets kind of overwhelming.
It does.
I'm just getting used to IE8, so I'm not quite ready for IE9 yet.
Yeah. But. All righty. Let's move on to our picks of the week.
And my pick this week is an iPod iPhone app. And I believe there's apps for other smartphones as well. And it is Dragon Diction. And what this allows you to do is dictate voice to your iPod or iPhone, and it will translate that into text and make it available for copying into other applications or for easy email, Facebook, or Twitter connection. And so I did some testing with it, used it on my iPod, did some dictating, and it actually picked up everything very well except for Wells Tech. I said Wells Tech, and it said Well, Texas instead. So,
is that your southern drawl? Was that your southern drawl? You just kind of insert Texas in there.
There you go. So, but it did very well. I took a screenshot. Maybe I'll have a link to that in the show notes somehow. But really simple interface. You just get one button, push the button, and it starts recording. And then you get the option of where you want to send it to. And you also get a keyboard option so you can, correct things like Well, Texas, if you need to. One thing it doesn't do is very much punctuation. So everything just kind of runs together what you said.
Which is maybe okay for text messaging and stuff. So
I just kind of like the idea of being able to just make a quick recording before you forget something and send it to yourself. So that you have some notes or whatever to go by when you have those brainstorms wherever or whenever that might be. So it's a free application, so you can't beat the price, and you may want to check it out if you have a smartphone that it works on, and we'll include links in the show notes for that.
Very good. Yeah, on my Android phone, at least with the latest update to the operating system, you can say "note to self" and then you know speak the note, and it'll actually text text yourself. Or I think it even does email as well. You think you can configure it that way. So that's a real handy feature, especially if you're just you don't have paper and pencil handy. You can get that stuff recorded. So good stuff. My pick is actually a series of picks, and this was kind of my last week's plight. Now that I had gotten the bad news, and we reported this last week, that Xmarx was going out of business, which we've mentioned on the show before. Xmarx is a bookmark syncing tool. I use a number of different browsers. We need to test the different things we roll out in the Synod office and beyond on a number of different browsers to make sure they work. So I have the four main browsers. So I have IE, I have Chrome, I have Firefox, I have Safari, just to make sure that the pages are rendering correctly in all of them. And Xmarx was a great way, because it worked on all those platforms, to keep all my bookmarks in sync. So it really didn't matter what site or what browser I was using, or even what computer I was using. As long as Xmarx was installed, I could have the same set of bookmarks available to me. Well, they're going out of business, or at least their free version is not going to be available anymore. I think they're going to try and revive the business in a pay-for model, which I'm not interested in doing. So my last week, I was trying to find an alternative, and I think I've cobbled together, and maybe cobble is is probably the right word, because there's not one solution that I think fits the bill here, but I think I have a workable solution, and it's not overly complicated. And many of the tools, there's three tools here that I'm going to mention as picks, and all of them are free, and we've mentioned almost all of them on the show before. The base of all this, the solution that I'm talking about here, is Google Bookmarks. Google does have a bookmarking function. It has a site where you can tag things, where it's cloud-based and you can import and export, just a basic bookmarking tool. Kind of like Delicious or Digo or something like that, without kind of the social part of it, although I do think it has a social tool if you want to use it that way, but nobody really uses it in that fashion. So it's kind of a private bookmarking engine. So that's where I've got all my bookmarks, and that seems to work really well. Now, the problem is, if I left it there, I'd have to go to that site every time I wanted to click on a bookmark, and clearly that's not going to work for me. I need my bookmarks on my toolbar, one click or two clicks away, whatever browser I'm in. And they also need to be able to be hierarchically organized, so I can put them in folders and subfolders. So what I've done, at least for Internet Explorer, is I have reinstalled, which I had uninstalled a number of months back, Google Toolbar, which does integrate very nicely with Google Bookmarks. And so you have a bookmark button at the top in the bar. You click it and down drops a drop down where you can click your folder and then whatever bookmark you would like to check off. We've already talked about Google Toolbar, so I'm not going to go through many of the other features, although it has many more. But that allows me to get at my Google Bookmarks and even manage my Google Bookmarks through the toolbar. The one snag that I hit, and this is the third, the third leg of this three-legged stool, is in Google Chrome. Interestingly enough, you can't install Google Toolbar, so which seems very odd to me. So what I had to do there is find an extension that would bring in my Google bookmarks, and that is an extension called Yagbe, Y-A-G-B-E, yet another Google bookmarks extension. Very simple tool. It just appears as a little star icon up in the toolbar. You click it, and this is actually very cool. It drops down a kind of a file explorer list where it has a tree structure. So you click on one and it expands what's under that and under that and under that. And then it reads my Google bookmarks and I can manage them right there as well. So I've got it covered in my two main browsers, which are IE and Google Chrome, but it also works on Firefox and Safari as well. So that was my plight, and I think I've come to it works really well. And it takes a little bit of a setup, but I think I now am back in bookmark heaven.
Okay, Martin, so you taught me a new term. You're going to have to be on standby as I type up the show notes so you can do spell check on
probably wasn't even
together.
A word. Oh, cobble,
but,
yes.
But, you know, I do a lot of cobbling together, and it's really hard to wrap my brain around making things like that work. And once it does work, I totally forget how I did it. So if I ever lose it, I'm in deep trouble. But as long as things like that work for me, I am a happy girl in heaven. So sounds like a great solution.
So I'll give a report card in 3 months. It may be different, but right now it seems to be working really well.
Well, you will be given a report card because that'll be about the time that we do our best and worst picks of the year. So we'll see how it goes if it makes the list.
Right. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Always stirs up a couple hornet's nests, so that's good.
Oh, great reminder there.
Let's move on to community feedback.
Yeah, we heard from Cindy Krieger, who's out in Michigan. She works actually for the state of Michigan and is a member, I believe, of Shepherd of the Hills in Lansing, if I'm remembering correctly. And Cindy sent us an interesting article. It's that URL shortening services are not great for business-related links. And this made me a little bit nervous, Martin, because I am a fan of Bitly, bit.ly, which you can use for great shortening of those long URLs, and you can actually customize the link to be something that has a little bit of meaning to you. And what this particular user that wrote this article had experienced was people can mark your links as spam. And so when people go to use your Bitly links, they get a spam page. This page has been reported as potentially damaging or something to that effect. And even though it isn't spam, you can get this applied to you erroneously. And so here you've set up a link, and Bitly even tracks statistics on your links and things like that. Seems like a great service, but it's out of your control what may get marked as potential spam. And so there's even some comments and discussion about this on this particular article. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And I'm not quite sure if we're going to have to look for a different solution for that, especially for our, you know, official links that we're trying to send out to people. There are free open source URL shortening software available for download and installation on web servers. So if you go to the trouble of cobbling together a solution, you might be able to come up with an alternative that you could host on your own domain. But I haven't done that yet, so I can't say that I recommend any of those yet.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. We could do some kind of Wells one if we wanted, you know, we.ls, or I don't know if that's even a domain, but it'd be interesting to look into. And sounds like all you really need is a server, and away you go. So
there you go. Mm-hmm. All right, next up we heard from Ben Martins, who is a member, I believe he told us, of Calvary Lutheran in Bellevue, Washington. And he wrote to us wondering if we had any solutions for a SharePoint-type workspace for congregational uses. And one of his main criteria was that it be either free or very affordable, because congregations obviously don't have extra money to put toward, you know, heavy hosting fees and things. For those that aren't familiar, SharePoint is a Microsoft product. We actually use it for our Connect website, and it is very much geared toward internal type communications. It has lots of bells and whistles to make intranets very usable collaborative environments for groups. But it does come with a bit of a price tag, and maybe that price tag, I think Ben even said that he had looked into it, and the cheapest he had found was $10 for a gig of storage space per month for SharePoint usage or whatever. So an alternative that we recommend, Ben, is to use Google Apps. And
Google Sites, even if you don't go to the trouble of installing Google Apps on your domain, Google Site can be set up to be private as well. So, but Google Apps is free for nonprofits as well as for education, and it comes with a lot of those collaborative type bells and whistles as well. You can, you know, share calendars and documents and wikis and all those kind of things that might be of use. And so I know several of our congregations have gone this route, and it does take a little bit of work to get it set up with your hosting provider. But once you do, it can actually be integrated with your domain and allow you a lot of privacy for your internal workings of your congregation.
Mm-hmm. You use that, don't you, Sally, at Sleepy Eye?
We have gone down the path. We aren't quite 100% that direction yet, but we do have the domain side of it set up and actually working towards getting our email converted over to Gmail, which is part of the Google Apps suite within your own domain. So
we've set it up for our intranet. We don't use the email portion, but we do it for file sharing, and our coordinating council, which is our main church council, uses it for meeting minutes and reports, that kind of thing. So we haven't gotten too deeply into it, but it's working well for us at this point.
Mm-hmm. So we'd be interested to hear back from you, Ben, if you make a decision, go one way or another. Ben said he was a Microsoft employee, so I think he's a little bit leaning toward the SharePoint side of things.
Yep.
So maybe he'll find an affordable solution for that. We'll be anxious to hear how it develops.
You can always set up your own server, and there is a free version of SharePoint. So the team site side of it can be downloaded and installed and used that way. So if you're just into that and they have the ability to load your own server, then that's always an option.
Yep. Lots of fun things to learn in
next
the process,
some,
I'm sure.
Yeah. Next, some very sad news, Sally.
Oh, I was really disheartened to hear this, but this was an announcement from Frito-Lay last week, and you may think that's odd that we're talking about Frito-Lay on our Wells Tech podcast, but if you listen to show 128, which was titled The Sound of Green, we had a special sound clip that we played, and it was from our Sun Chips bag here at the Tech Capital and the Draper household in Sleepy Eye. We had a compostable Sun Chips bag, which was, you know, green technology at its finest. They had made the bag so that it disintegrated within 13 weeks or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the offshoot of that was that it was extremely noisy, and we actually recorded a sound clip of that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Frito-Lay has gotten enough complaints at this point. They've decided to abandon the noisy Sun Chip bag.
Yep. So if all of you with those bags, save them, because they will be collector's items. So.
Save them for 13 weeks, and then they'll disintegrate.
Yeah, you've got to sign. Yeah, that's true. You've got to preserve them somehow, I suppose.
So.
Interesting. All right.
Interesting news. I guess that's the way it'll be as we get more and more into green technology. There'll be some trial and error along the way.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
Next up, we heard from Pastor Michael Johnson. He wrote that at their latest circuit meeting in the Appleton area, they were looking at the issue of privacy laws and potential effects on congregations. And so he's looking for some direction on anything like that, any discussions we've had on the podcast or potentially future discussions on the podcast related to privacy, things like emails, as well as just, you know, Facebook correspondence or whatever it might be, sharing information and keeping privacy in mind as you do that. So if any of our listeners have experience beyond, I know we've had discussions about email retention and that kind of thing on past podcasts, but we'd love to hear from our listeners on this topic as well.
Yep, and not a bad idea to have a privacy policy, certainly on your website, but also for many of the other things that are now going on within congregations as far as recording of services and, you know, congregational databases, online databases, those kinds of things are all privacy-related and things that you probably should have a policy on. So we would love your feedback on that and your and any ideas that you have that, or any resources that you might have that we could point folks to.
Very good. Now we're going to jump into the DIGO section of our
listener feedback. We use DIGO as one way that people can tag things with the tag Wells Tech, and we'll be able to share them on the podcast. And this week, Gail Potratz from Emmanuel in New London, Wisconsin, shared a link to CISE, I guess is how you might pronounce that, C-I-E-S-E, and it's the Center for Innovation in Engineering and Science Education. And this comes actually from the Stevens Group that she works with at that summer conference each summer. And this is actually a page for K through 12 educators to participate in collaborative global initiatives throughout the school year. And they have different projects listed, things like the Global Water Sampling Project for grades 6 through 12, where you take water samples and share your findings and see how it compares around the world. There's one geared for grades 1 through 5 called Bucket Buddies, where you do similar things, taking samples in ponds and answering questions about it and sharing that collaboratively. They have all grade levels covered. They have a lot of different topics in science available here. So if you're looking to collaborate, this may be a place for our teacher in the audience to check out.
Very good. Thanks, Gail.
Yep. And also on DIGO, we heard from this fellow named Martin. So maybe you can share what you shared on DIGO.
I found a couple of Google-related things that I wanted to share. One is kind of a more sad news that we've talked about on the show before. Goog 411 is dead as well. So no more Sunship bags at Crinkle and no more Goog 411. Goog 411 was an 800 service that you could call from any phone, but normally it was helpful to call from a cell phone. Voice recognition software behind the scenes, but it basically worked like a 411 call where you would say what you're looking for. It would ask for the location or the business or whatever it is and the city and state, and then it would provide, would do a search, and then it would provide you results, and you would say, I want number 2, and it would either give you the number or would dial the number directly. It worked really, I thought it worked really, really well. So they're discontinuing that service. Android phones have this kind of built in, so there's not a need for it necessarily there, especially with the data plans and web searching and those kinds of things. And other phones have different tools that'll do this as well, but I think for the regular old feature phone that many of us still use, you know, the flip phones or whatever, this was a great tool that I think will be missed.
Yeah, and of course they do temper their announcement with the fact that they've gathered a lot of data in the process, and their voice recognition algorithms are just getting better and better, and there's more to come from Google, so we'll wait and see what their newest big adventure is now that this is going away.
Yep. And the other thing I noticed from Google is they've launched a new contest to encourage kids to code. So I haven't looked too much into this, Sally. I think you did a little bit because you've got a coder at home, but apparently they're offering a pretty nice prize and some requirements to get kids interested in developing software code.
Yeah, I shared this link with my three sons. Actually, two of them are old enough to participate. It looks like it's going to not start up until November 22nd. Right. But what they're going to do is allow kids to be a part of actual coding projects. So maybe they're writing code or doing testing or writing documentation or doing training materials, lots of different jobs around the coding projects, and they'll actually get paid $100 per project that they participate in, up to a maximum of $500, and the winner of the competition that is around this is going to get an all expense paid trip to the Google campus. So I have some boys that are gearing up to make their trip to Google and very excited about this contest. So we'll see how that develops. But I found another programming contest just to keep with the theme. This one is sponsored by the National STEM, which stands for, I believe, Science and Technology education. I don't see... Science, technology, engineering, and math education.
Okay.
And they're actually announcing and opening up this contest today, October 12th, as we're recording this. And this is for middle school grade students, grades 5 through 8. And what they're going to be encouraged to do is use a programming platform like Scratch, and they list a couple others, GameMaker and GameStar Mechanic, to actually create an online game that has an education focus. And they have a $50,000 prize pool for this contest. So once again, I have a couple of sons that fall in this age category, and we're going to be looking into this. And I would encourage you to share this with the middle school students in your life and see if they can come up with an education game that mm-hmm. could win this contest.
Sally, you're proving once again that the Draper family is about the geekiest family around.
And we're proud of it.
You are proud of it. That's awesome. I think that's cool. That's very cool.
Yeah. So. Fun stuff.
And you came across one more for community feedback, one more item.
That's right. I thought this was really interesting. I came across, through Free Technology for Teachers blog, a podcast with Lee LaFever. Now, that may not ring a bell with you, that name, but you certainly have seen his work, and that is the Common Craft Show, the series of videos called In Plain English. He has mm-hmm. blogs in plain English and wikis in plain English and RSS in plain English. I think he actually mentioned in the podcast he has about 36 plain English videos out there. And the podcast recording or interview that he did is with a podcast, I think, that's labeled explicit, but there is nothing about this particular interview that has anything explicit in it. So, you know, just have that disclaimer as you look at this. Mm-hmm. But and maybe you don't listen to the whole thing, because a lot of it, he gets into their business model and how they set up their business and things like that. But what I think that is really worthy is he talks about how to give clear explanations, and especially brief explanations. And I think if you've watched any of his videos, you would agree that they are really masters at that skill. So we can all learn from this. We all have a message. You know, the ultimate message is to share the gospel message. And then as teachers or presenters, pastors, obviously, we want to share that in a clear way and as concisely as possible so that people get it. You know,
yep.
And I think listening to Lee will give you some definite tips on how to do that. One of the main things he says is to not assume that your audience knows anything, you know, to make them comfortable by starting at the very beginning and giving them a good basis to go on. And I think he offers a lot more tips. And literally in just the first 10 or 15 minutes of this podcast interview, I think it would be worth your time.
Very good.
Yeah.
Nice catch, Sally. Thank you. And great feedback. If you too would like to contribute to the WellsTech podcast and get a mention here and share what you think might be valuable for other listeners, please do so. WellsTech@wells.net is our email. WellsTech.wells.net is our website. You can leave us a voicemail. We'd love to get some voicemails. We haven't had any in a while, so please consider that. All kinds of other ways to get in touch with us. Thanks to everybody who contributed this week. Next week, we return to our focus on the school and church secretaries and administration in the church and school office. And we're going to be talking about something that is probably extremely important in both schools and churches all across our synod and every other, you know, organization, and that is organizing volunteers. How to track them, how to administer them, how to communicate with them, how to maybe to incent them, to reward them, all kinds of good stuff. So if you have a church or school secretary that is not listening to the show, please let them know that next week this show is for them, and we'll be talking about organizing volunteers.
Very important topic.
Yep. Let's close the show with the music of Revelation and their song, You Are the God, from their album, Led by the Light. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
is your name.